Tonight's topic is intriguing because I wasn't expecting that engineers would want to know about meditation and spiritual solutions for sustainability. But when we consider the present circumstances humanity finds itself in, naturally, an intelligent, open-minded person would seek other options, even other paradigms. My quest for following the trail for solutions to all humanity's problems began during my years at Yale University, in which my academic advisors gave me the luxury of studying whatever I wanted to study, because I told them my quest was to find that magic bullet, get to the root of all human problems. So they told me, study whatever you like, and after 4 years, if you find the solution to all human problems, please come back and let us know. I'm approaching the present human crisis from the ancient viewpoint of the Bhakti Yoga texts. Those texts, especially Bhagavad Gita, the Song of the Supreme Opulent One, focus our spotlight on consciousness as the make it or break it for human beings. When we consider the present times, we can remember a Chinese saying which sometimes is taken as a blessing, but actually it's a curse. May you live in interesting times. Certainly, these years are very interesting. Can humanity come up with solutions to the interrelated complex problems of today? Problems that dwarf our governmental institutions because these problems are so interlocked. Problems that exceed the financial quarter of a corporation, or exceed the term of a politician, problems that are global, whether economic, political, or environmental. What can the Bhakti Yoga meditational texts teach that could rescue our present situation? Because I'd like to present to you that we don't really have an earth problem, we have a human problem. Human consciousness needs to be rescued. Not so much that the earth needs to be rescued. We consider the sea levels rising faster than any time since ancient Rome. More than any time in 28 centuries. When we consider that since 1997, there have been 11 of the hottest years ever recorded. And last year, as you know, smashed the record of 2014. Of course, last year had the El Nino effect, but still, a thoughtful person is wondering what kind of world will I become older in, and what kind of world I'll leave to my children. We're talking about human perception and human consciousness. The biggest challenge we face is shifting that human consciousness. In other words, the genuine yogi, the genuine meditator, recognizes that humanity's problem is not so much the eroding glaciers, not so much the reality of limited resources. No, the problem is inside the human mind. Let's consider. The inability of many human beings to logically consider the effects of environmental damage. There's a study done at University of California, Berkeley, about how the more truth you tell about global warming, climate destabilization, climate change, the more the information you give is dire, the more the mind rejects it. In other words, the information, when presented in its starkness, invites rejection because the human mind has a certain construction. This is something yogis and meditators are quite familiar with, the patterns of human thinking. Why should you violate my just world perception? The world should be well ordered and respond to my hard labor and individual merit. To hear that, or to see that, children and other innocent persons would be severely disadvantaged by environmental problems cannot be accepted. There are various filters operating within that just world paradigm. The first filter is finite pool of worry. I've got so many things to think about during my day. I'm trying to pay for this, trying to pay for that. I don't have enough room in my finite pool of worry to take on all the dire news of environmental degradation. The other is the single action bias. I've bought the proper light bulbs. I'm good. I recycle my waste. I'm good. So I don't have to worry anymore about doing my part to avert environmental crisis. I'm giving you just a slice of that kind of information to show that it could possibly be true that we've met the enemy and the enemy's us, but we don't know what us is. And this, what is the us? What is the actual entity that's causing all this havoc? Or what is that entity that could possibly climb to unimaginable heights? What is that entity? In the Prime Bhakti Yoga text, Krishna explains that our real identity is of a particle of indestructible consciousness. And that particle of indestructible consciousness is not the same as the body and mind. In other words, by going the meditation and yoga route, we're actually heading deep into the non-physicality of the self. And certainly, approaching that kind of reality is life-changing. Although human consciousness is so crucial, because everything that we are aware of comes to us by virtue of our consciousness, comes to us via consciousness, consciousness still remains such a mystery. You can take a very dogmatic reductionist position that everything in the universe has to be physical, therefore consciousness has to be physical, because if we dared to consider something else, there'd be an earthquake under us, literally, in terms of our foundational conceptions of what is life and how to live. We can say that consciousness is just an illusion. Or we can say that consciousness indicates a distinct reality from matter, the dualistic position, which some say is ludicrous. But what the Bhakti Yoga texts explain, especially what Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, is that although there's a distinction between physical matter and consciousness, they both emanate from the same source. And the goal of the yoga and meditation system is how to connect to that source, take knowledge from that source. You may know that approximately 20 million persons in the USA practice yoga, and a growing number are looking to meditation. In fact, right now in New York City, enterprising persons have opened up in Manhattan various meditation drop-by centers. And you can subscribe so you can come whenever you want for a mere $3,000 a year. People are stressed. The world is changing rapidly. People are looking to a future of apparently diminished economic gains. The latest reports are that global economic growth has considerably slowed and shows no sign of picking up. This is bad for the traditional way of Western happiness. Western happiness is about more than just, do I feel good now? Although that's very important. Western happiness is also mainly about, is my life improving? Do I feel like progress is happening? Very important psychologically. So when there is a slowdown in economic possibilities, people become very disturbed. About 10 years ago, an economist at Harvard, Benjamin Friedman, published a seminal text called The Moral Consequences of Growth. There, he sought to establish a close relationship between people's good behavior, their moral behavior, and economic growth. He noted that when the economy is booming, or at least moving along quite nicely, people are more liberal, they're more democratic, they're more tolerant. But when economies slow down or even come to a complete halt, people become the opposite. Very intolerant, very prone to authoritarianism, because they need to feel that their life is improving. That is a central Western gospel. Materially, your life has to improve. So therefore, regardless of its environmental implications, economic growth must be there to provide morality. From the viewpoint of the Bhakti Yoga texts, basing morality, good behavior, good qualities on economic growth is very shaky business. Why not understand through proper yoga and meditation the glories of the non-material self? And then such a practitioner can be established in real prosperity, inner prosperity that can't be shaken even amidst the greatest external difficulties. Now is a good time for reevaluating what is the mission of society, what is the story that society founds itself upon. Obviously, as you know, the earth cannot handle limitless economic aspirations. The average North American or Western European demands of the earth approximately 4 times as much as everyone else. As a whole, humanity as a whole, we're living on right now about 1.5 planet Earths in terms of our resource consumption and our disposal of waste. Here is the question. Even if the Earth could provide the resources for unlimited consumption, and even if the Earth could provide unlimited sink for the disposal of waste, still human beings would not be satisfied. And of course, we know the earth cannot provide limitless resources or limitless sink for waste disposal. Yet again, even if it could, human beings would not be satisfied. What would be the cause of that constant, ongoing lack of satiation? Behavioral economists come up with terms that actually match the information given in these ancient Bhakti Yoga texts. Habituation. You get something good, you get something nice, but after a while you get used to it. It becomes a habit, you become habituated to it. Then there's something called the impact bias. You're always anticipating the future bang that you'll get from something, whether from an acquisition or from an accomplishment or from a relationship or achievement. It's the human tendency to always calculate the bang that we'll get. And that calculation, also known as emotional forecasting, drives us onward. Yes, I'm going to do this because I can see the impact that's in it for me. Well, the news of behavioral economists is that we're always wrong. We always overshoot in our estimation. This leads to a phenomenon of humanity called nexting. You know about texting. So nexting means it's the next thing that's always luring us onward. When human beings are afflicted by these apparently inherent syndromes, how can we expect any peace and clarity of vision? I've been traveling on every continent of the world, except Antarctica, for the past 40 years. And I can tell you what certainly you could intuit. If I'm speaking in a third world country, if I'm speaking, let's say, in India or South Africa, those students at universities there have no intention, generally speaking, have no intention of aspiring for any slowdown in consumption, any moderation of consumption. They want what North America and Western Europe seem to have. They don't want to feel that they're too late for the party. They're just now feeling that their time in the sun has come. The first world has been partying for so long. Why should the party stop now just because the earth is in the condition of danger? Currently, if everyone lived on the standard of the average person in India, if the ecological footprint matched the average person in India, we just need one planet Earth. Currently, that's the calculation for India. But having been to India every year since 1977, I can tell you, no one intends to keep things on that level. So what are we going to do? You can't tell people the party's over in those countries. We can't tell human beings in the first world that the party is over. The just world syndrome often repels that, as this study at UC Berkeley discovered. The world can't be so unjust. I'm working hard. I have individual merit. Surely the world will provide at least a basic normalcy and stability. We don't want our ontological security threatened. Otherwise, it's very terrifying. So social scientists have found that if you tell the truth, for example, that the time when humanity can rely upon predictable ocean levels and therefore build great coastal cities, that time is finished. It's quite threatening. Materially, we're up against so many obstacles in trying to inspire change. If we can adopt another avenue, if we can at least consider another avenue, a non-material approach, we might find great value in that. We have a hang-up about the physicalness of the universe. that everything we contact, as well as everything we haven't contacted yet, is measurable and conceivable according to what we know now of physical things. I'll give you an example. Only approximately 4% of the energy density in the universe is measurable. Yet, we indulge in a tautology. We call what we don't know about dark matter or dark energy. Dark means who knows, but calling it energy or matter implies that it's like what we do know and it's like what we can measure. To consider otherwise is a bit threatening. So human beings project into what is totally unknown what is known. This is another mistake made by, the yoga texts would say, impure consciousness. The bhakti yoga lifestyle that Krishna presents in Bhagavad Gita and its advanced texts is about lifestyle engineering, how to shape your lifestyle so that your perceptions change, your consciousness becomes clear, and you can actually experience the non-material reality and its source, rather than just have religious beliefs. I have a tradition, every time I speak here at Penn, of reminding the audience, because there's a lot of curiosity about meditation and yoga. So I remind them that in that prime meditation and yoga text, Bhagavad Gita, nowhere does Krishna ask for religious belief. The tendency is to think that metaphysical refers to what is beyond measurement, beyond the physical that we often assume is all there is. And of course, there can't be anything beyond that. But if there is, you put a name on it, like metaphysical, like fairy tale. But that means that approximately 96% of the universe is metaphysical because there's no clue what it is. Every year, another hope arises. It could be this, it could be that. Every year, the hope fades. What I'm trying to say is that we're actually living and dealing with the metaphysical and the unknown all the time, regardless of the labels we put. Is there another way that we can access the secrets of the self? And that means accessing what is consciousness. As you know, there's not one device in the world that can directly detect the presence of consciousness. We simply have to say that, well, I know what it's like to be conscious, first person, so you must know what it's like to be conscious. Should consciousness just be limited to human beings? Many are surprised to know that at a grand gathering of the world's top scientists at Oxford 4 years ago, a document was signed declaring that animals have consciousness. Yet, after that grand declaration, the scientists sat down for a dinner of animal flesh. From the viewpoint of the yoga texts by engaging in unnecessary violence, our consciousness becomes impaired. So therefore, lifestyle is so important. How to check the force of material desire and greed and anger. That's just the preliminary. And then, through proper technique, applied spiritual technology, we can indeed experience a superior reality than just physicality. So I was speaking about the lack of exhortation to be a religious believer in Bhagavad Gita. Nowhere in Bhagavad Gita does Krishna say, just believe or just believe in me. Everywhere in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is giving process. Here is the methodology by which you can verify what I'm explaining about the material and the non-material. So that's what I call the most valuable engineering information. How to enter the laboratory, apply your instruments, your senses, and get the result. When we speak about Krishna, we're speaking about supreme consciousness. But that's very difficult because we don't even know what our little tiny bit of consciousness is. So therefore, the yoga and meditation system, when properly presented, first get us to understand our own identity as indestructible particles of consciousness. And then those indestructible particles, what are they in relation to? What are they part of? But it's very difficult for persons to accept that there's a supreme consciousness when they don't understand their own consciousness. So now we have 20 million persons in the USA practicing some kind of yoga for exercise generally. And then we have a burgeoning industry of mindfulness meditation. It's worth a few billion now, according to Forbes. Hopefully, gradually, people will start to understand what is the real purpose of all that meditation and yoga. It's to make the ultimate connection between the finite particle of consciousness and the infinite particle of consciousness. Infinite consciousness, not infinite particles, excuse me. What is the relationship between the two? The yoga texts talk about pure love, meaning no material conditions, no material influences. This is something that cannot be understood with a material lifestyle. How does all this relate to the present human plight? You see that unable to find stable and deep meaning within the self, because the self is a mystery, human beings then literally trample the earth in their quest to dominate material resources, their quest to dominate matter. There seems to be some fulfillment in doing that. There seems to be some gratifying sense of power and control. What the yoga texts tell us is that this syndrome evidences a totally misguided human being, a human being off the rails. The question we need to ask ourselves is whether human beings are mainly meant for economic growth or technological proliferation, or is there another mission for the human species? We look at again, the current human circumstances. You can wonder what will get us first, environmental havoc or nuclear havoc? What can restrain a human being? Some say it's not possible through traditional methods. Human beings have the existential sense of creatures that can only deal with what's immediate in time and space and can only relate to persons that look similar. Human beings just don't have the capacity to see beyond the immediate or deal with strangers, persons who look differently. What could be a solution? We have prestigious scholars at Oxford who are offering moral bioenhancement. It's unsure, but what other solution is there? Religion helps very modestly, according to an analysis of history. It doesn't really check the human craziness for self-destruction. Politics is ineffective. Perhaps by the use of neurochemicals, humanity can be saved from itself. Often there's some extreme reaction. I was speaking at Stanford about this, and this, I got into it more than I am today because the topic at Stanford was different. But the students were, wait a minute. Tinkering with the neurochemicals of human beings in order to make them peaceful and cooperative. So I took the viewpoint of these scholars at Oxford. Why not? Athletes take various chemicals for performance enhancement. Academics take chemicals for cognitive enhancement. Depressed persons take chemicals for balancing their brain. So why not administer to human beings chemicals that would make them more cooperative, more friendly? Yes, this is a serious field of research. There's even a research center at Oxford specifically devoted to this. I'd like to present another solution. Yes, we've met the enemy, and the enemy is us, but we don't know what us is. What's causing the commotion, what's causing the problem in human society is a lack of understanding what is the self. Indeed, some will say there's no self. Thinking that there's a self is an illusion. How are we going to resolve this mystery of the self? We can claim that consciousness, if it exists, it's something created by various neural states of the brain, created by the interaction of neurochemicals. We can say that, but there is no proof. Why not consider the ancient wisdom of the Bhakti Yoga, the Krishna conscious texts, that give processes. I'm a dual citizen, USA and New Zealand, so down under I say processes. So why not consider processes for verifying the non-material self and its relationship with the Supreme Self? But again, hearing talk about the Supreme Self makes many persons tremble. Uh-oh. sounds like we're going to be true believers with religion. We flinch like that because we actually don't even know what is our own tiny self. Am I this body? Am I the mind? Or am I something beyond the body and mind? So shall we simply believe dogmatically that everything is physical? There's nothing to me but matter? Or should we believe blindly that there's something spiritual? I don't know what it is, but I believe. Or should we see if there's a process for verifying the non-material reality of the self and then its relationship with the supreme consciousness, the supreme self? So this acquisition is the real gift of the yoga and meditation system. Granted, most persons don't know what's at the end of the road. But I'm presenting this information in the context of if we're actually going to get to the root of human problems, we need to take another road. As I pointed out in the beginning, for many persons, all right, you would say they're uneducated persons or uninformed persons. Still, you present the truth of the current environmental devastation and they can't handle it. Why should the world be like that? Well, I'm also thinking of the young persons in third world countries. Why? They say, why does the consumption have to stop now? Just like in South Africa, just 25 years ago or so, we got freedom. We're ready to consume. We're ready to increase our social mobility. We're ready to get what everyone else has. And now you say, slow down. Rampant economic growth is spoiling the planet. They don't want to hear it. And even in the first world, talk of no growth or limiting growth produces such paranoia. What politician in the USA would ever offer that? What politician in the UK or Western Europe would offer that? Even in New Zealand, my home base, classified by the UN as the most environmentally conscious country in the world, they won't elect a leader who says no economic growth. We have some deep thinking that's necessary for actually confronting humanity and its illusions. We need, as I said, lifestyle engineering, knowledge of how to change our lifestyle so that our experiences change. And that lifestyle engineering is based on the ancient wisdom that has done yogis and meditators well for thousands of years. Now, such wisdom can be spread to everyone. Then you would see a change in human beings. Should we consider moral bioenhancement? Even the advocates of that admit that they say probably the ones most needing of the biochemicals for changing their morality are the ones who are advocating it. They admit that. But they say there's no other option. No other solution has proved satisfactory. As you know, in the USA, for the next 30 years, the government's committed to what's the right political term? improving the safety and reliability, that's it, of the nuclear arsenal to the tune of $1 trillion for the next 30 years. And the common person has the understanding that such a nuclear arsenal is necessary to protect freedom. New Zealand, although part of the First World and a nominal ally of the USA, refuses to allow the US Navy to park its nuclear armed fleet there. And this has been a bit of a tug of war for a few decades now. For the New Zealander living in a social welfare state, $1 trillion, what that could do to improve the well-being of so many humans. The State Department's argument is, when there's some international crisis, when there's some international threat of war, who are you going to call? But perhaps it could be considered that it's better to take a risk and uplift the situation of the people rather than take a risk of spending so mightily for nuclear armaments while not tending to the needs of the people. It could be said that. But the purpose of my talk is not to deal with the obvious and well-known problems of an external sort. I am trying to point out that all these excesses and distortions are brought about by a distorted conception of the self. A human self that has no idea of what its real mission is. The yoga texts, the Krishna conscious literature, boldly declares that the mission of the human being is enlightenment, self-realization. That means understanding what is the non-material self, what is the supreme self, and the relationship between the two. By tapping into that kind of wealth, the human being doesn't trample and spoil the earth seeking external wealth. For example, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives the preliminary qualifications of a genuine yogi or meditator. Such a person is fully aware of his or her non-material identity as a particle of spiritual consciousness. Therefore, such a person is always joyful, not in a giddy way, but because of a lifestyle based on wisdom, applied wisdom. Such a person sees all living entities as equal because he or she sees that all living beings have this particle of spiritual consciousness in them. And that particle is equal, although the bodies are not equal. Some bodies are stronger, some bodies are smarter, some bodies are more beautiful. But the equality is in terms of the particle of spiritual consciousness, known in Sanskrit as the Atma. Furthermore, such a preliminarily advanced person no longer is riddled with desires for what he or she doesn't have and lamentations about what he or she is losing. That's a succinct analysis of prevalent syndrome of material existence. Hankering, longing, yearning, I don't have this, I don't have that. And you see how such a syndrome manifests because most people today cannot any longer discriminate between wants and needs. If I want something, I need it. So again, a preliminary qualification of a genuine meditator or yogi is no more of this artificial yearning and hankering for satisfaction through matter. And then no lamentation for what we're losing while we're hankering for more. That level of attainment qualifies the person, the meditator, for actual connection to the Supreme Reality. Bhagavad Gita describes that Supreme Reality as Krishna, which literally means the unlimitedly attractive source of pleasure. Who would not want to make a connection with the unlimited source of pleasure? Is this mythology? Is this a fairy tale? The accomplished yogis and meditators look at the situation in another way. This notion that everything is just physical and that consciousness is either an illusion or it's produced by the brain. Is that a mythology? Is that a myth? Is that a fairy tale? As Krishna explains in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, what is daytime for the introspective sage is nighttime for the externally absorbed materialist, and vice versa. There are two different ways of living and looking at things. So we have to determine how we can engineer our lifestyle to attain the widest experience, the deepest experience. So again, as I said in the beginning, the problem we're facing is not so much the eroding glaciers. What will happen with Greenland and Antarctica? The problem is not so much rising sea levels. Although if you live in Miami Beach, Charleston, South Carolina, or Norfolk, Virginia, as a regular occurrence, you're dealing with tidal floods of 1 or 2 feet. Doesn't sound like much, but lawns are destroyed, trees are killed, drainage systems are ruined. And that's damage is considered just a beginning. The problem is not all that, though. The problem is inside the human mind. And the yogis and meditators would be more precise in saying the problem is inside the human consciousness. And that consciousness lets you know that there is a non-material self. And that we'll never understand consciousness materially because consciousness is indicating a non-material reality. Is that just a myth or a folk belief, or can it be verified? Here is where I say the crossroads of human civilization is. Are we material or non-material? If I'm material, then my goal in life would be to arrange matter in as pleasing way as possible, dominate material resources in a civil way as much as possible. But if I'm not non-material, then what is my non-material mission? I'm offering this as a way to practically reduce the human impact on the environment, because if the human being is self-satisfied, he or she ceases to cause problems for other human beings, for other species of life, and for nature. Sustainable happiness has to be on the spiritual plane. That is the message of Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. How to try for happiness in a way that doesn't inconvenience or minimize other persons, other species of life, and future generations. That kind of happiness is not on the material plane. Albert Einstein is attributed for the statement that a problem is never solved on the same level that originated it. So yes, I'm presenting a different level than the one originating the problem. Thank you for your kind attention. Perhaps, if there are any questions. I know I've said some bold things. You're a very erudite audience. But before I'm finished, I'd like to ask for your participation in a group meditation. You heard some of it in the beginning. Mantra. And you may wonder, what is this mantra stuff anyway? Let's deal with the precise Sanskrit term, mantra. It actually means a sound that can deliver the mind from material entanglement, material illusion. Sounds are very potent. Sounds are able to induce illusion, and sounds are able to induce clarity. A major part of the genuine yoga and meditation system is sonic therapy, the use of sound to cleanse the mirror of our consciousness from the dust of material illusions.